Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We're pleased that the Supreme Court rejected the extreme legal theory presented in this case, which would have interfered with state governments, which would have opened the door for politicians to undermine the will of the people.
The Supreme Court begins its final week of the term by dismissing the independent state legislature theory that state legislatures can write election rules and draw congressional maps not subject to review by state courts. We'll speak with Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice, author of The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America. Then, poverty is the fourth leading cause of death in the United States.
Poverty kills 2.5 times more than drug overdoses. Cumulative poverty lingers year after year, and cumulative poverty is associated with 60% more death than current poverty. Really? Putting only heart disease and cancer and smoking-related deaths above the number of people that are killed by poverty.
We'll speak with Bishop William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign, then to Honduras, where residents are fighting private charter cities established by U.S. corporations with autonomy from the national government.
My name is Vanessa Cardenas. I'm from the community of Crawfish Rock, the Bay Island of Ratan, Honduras. And my fight is against the charter city, and especially the city of Prospera. It's, you know, because of the law that it has and also the negative impact that they have had on our community, their lack of transparency.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court's rejected a legal theory that would have radically increased the power of state legislatures to reshape how federal elections are conducted and would have made it easier to draw up gerrymandered congressional maps. Writing for the majority in Tuesday's 6-3 ruling, Chief Justice John Roberts rejected the so-called independent state legislature theory promoted by North Carolina Republican lawmakers. The decision comes as the Supreme Court is poised to deliver major rulings on affirmative action and the fate of President Biden's student debt relief. We'll have more on this week's blockbuster cases at the Supreme Court after headlines. In climate news, smoke from unprecedented Canadian wildfires darkened skies over much of the Midwestern United States Tuesday, triggering very unhealthy air quality warnings in Chicago, Detroit, and Milwaukee. Forecasters predict winds will push the smoke further east today, bringing a return of hazardous air to New York and parts of the Northeast. This week, the plume from worsening fires in Quebec and Ontario across the North Atlantic, bringing hazy skies to Spain and Portugal. Meanwhile, there are warnings and advisories for excessive heat in effect again today in several southwestern and southern states. The Electric Reliability Council of Texas reports record power consumption amidst a three-week-old heat wave that sent temperatures as high as 120 degrees Fahrenheit or 49 degrees Celsius. The Texas Tribune reports at least 9 prisoners, including 2 men in their 30s, have died of heart attacks or unknown causes this month in prisons lacking air conditioning. Science communicator Susan Joy Hassel says a collapse of Texas's overstrained electrical grid right now would lead to widespread deaths.
The Texas grid appears to be very vulnerable to a heat event like this because it doesn't have the capacity to bring in power from other places. And this heat dome is really expanding. You know, they say 50 million people are already exposed to dangerous heat by this heat dome.
A Russian missile attack on the eastern Ukrainian city of Kramatorsk has killed at least 9 civilians, including 3 children. Tuesday evening's attack on a crowded pizzeria just after 8 p.m. local time left dozens more injured. This is Valentina, a 64-year-old who witnessed the aftermath of the assault.
I ran here after the explosion. I run a cafe nearby. Everything has been blown up here. There is nothing. No windows, no doors. That's what I see. Destruction everywhere. It is fear, horror in the 21st century. I don't even know how to describe it. My son was killed in the war. And now this.
Belarus's leader says he convinced the head of Russia's Wagner group to call off a mutiny last weekend that saw heavily armed mercenaries advance to within 120 miles of Moscow. President Alexander Lukashenko said during a weekend phone call, Russian President Vladimir Putin promised to wipe out Wagner's forces and was considering killing Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin. Lukashenko said he later relayed Putin's comments to Prigozhin in a separate call.
He says, but we want justice. They want to strangle us. We will march in Moscow. And I say, halfway there, they will squash you like a bug.
U.S. intelligence officials have told New York Times senior Russian General Sergei Sorovkin had advanced knowledge of Prigozhin's plans to rebel against Russia's military leadership. The Times reports the officials are trying to learn if the general helped plan Prigozhin's mutiny. On Tuesday, Russia's embattled defense minister, Sergei Shoigu, whom Prigozhin has assailed for mismanaging Russia's war in Ukraine, appeared publicly as President Putin led a Moscow ceremony honoring Russian soldiers and police for their actions during the mutiny. The Biden administration's imposed new sanctions on companies accused of profiting from the activities of the Wagner Group in Africa. The Treasury Department says the sanctions will punish 4 companies based in Russia, the United Arab Emirates, and the Central African Republic that extract gold, diamonds, and other minerals to help fund the mercenary force. The sanctions were announced after Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Monday Wagner mercenaries will not be withdrawn from Africa following last week's mutiny.
Several hundred Russian servicemen are working in the Central African Republic as instructors. This work will, of course, be continued.
In Sierra Leone, President Julius Maada Bio has won re-election following a tense presidential contest over the weekend that was marred by police violence. He narrowly escaped a runoff election, securing over 55% of the vote needed to declare victory. His main opponent, Samora Kamara of the All People's Congress, has rejected official results. He said on social media, quote, "It's a sad day for our beloved country. It's a frontal attack on our fledgling democracy." Thousands of nurses in Texas and Kansas walked off the job Tuesday for a one-day strike to demand better workplace safety. Nurses have denounced chronic understaffing at 3 Ascension hospitals in Wichita and Austin. It was the largest nurses' strike in Texas and Kansas history. This is Natasha Gosek, a neonatal intensive care unit nurse who's worked at Ascension Seton Medical Center in Austin for 14 years.
I know a lot of coworkers and a lot of new nurses, their first thing to do when they get in their car after a 14-hour shift is they just cry and release all of the previous 14 hours so that they can compose themselves to go home to their families and not carry that with them as best as they can. Because they know that they've been called to this profession, they've been driven to this profession to take care of babies, to care of families, and they're not able to do that.
Here in New York, serious misconduct and neglect by guards at a city federal jail are what led to serial pedophile Jeffrey Epstein's death by suicide in 2019. That's according to a years-long investigation by the Justice Department, which released a 120-page report Tuesday accusing officials at the now-shuttered MCC, Metropolitan Correctional Center, of creating an environment that allowed Epstein the opportunity to hang himself. DOJ Inspector General Michael Horowitz detailed the findings Tuesday.
Had Epstein's cell been searched as required, it would have revealed that Epstein had excess prison blankets, linens, and clothing in his cell. MCC New York staff also failed to ensure that the institution's security camera system was fully functional, resulting in limited recorded video evidence. While we determined MCC New York staff engaged in significant misconduct, we didn't uncover evidence contradicting the FBI's determination that there was no criminality in connection with how Epstein died.
At the time of his death, Jeffrey Epstein was awaiting trial for sex trafficking and other charges. In more news from New York, Gothamist reports the city's Department of Correction is planning to purchase over $90,000 worth of high-powered submachine guns for a specially trained emergency security unit working at the troubled Rikers Island jail complex. This comes after New York's Department of Correction earlier this month cut some $17 million in jobs, in job training and social programs for prisoners. New York voters headed to the polls Tuesday for an off-year primary election to choose several city council seats and two district attorney races. Longtime progressive Charles Barron failed to keep his New York City council seat, losing to Chris Banks, who was backed by House Democratic Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries. In the most closely watched race, Yusuf Salam, one of the exonerated Central Park Five, was declared the winner in a contested bid for a city council seat in Harlem. Salam defeated Democratic Assemblywoman Inez Dickens, who had received the endorsement of New York Mayor Eric Adams by a landslide. Salam was one of five Black and Latinx teenagers wrongfully convicted of the 1989 beating and rape of a white woman. He spent 7 years in jail. Yusuf Salam has said he will overhaul New York City's criminal legal system, end mass incarceration, and help bring about police reform. To see our 2016 interview with Yusuf Salam, go to democracynow.org. And in Manhattan, public housing tenants rallied on Tuesday to demand the city halt its controversial $1.5 billion plan to demolish two public housing complexes and replace them with new high-rise apartments. Officials say the plan to tear down the Fulton and Chelsea Elliott houses is more cost-effective than repairing the apartments. But tenants argue the demolition will drive further privatization, gentrification, and displacement. Some tenants opposed to the demolition reported they were turned away by city authorities Tuesday as they tried to attend a resident engagement meeting. This is George Weaver, a Fulton tenant since 1993.
We got a mental crisis. We got a homeless crisis. Look at it. It's going to get worse if we tear down public housing. Yep. We're going to have people sleeping in the streets all over. And it's not just happening in New York. It's happening all across America. You see what happened in Chicago in the last mayor's race. That was a proven point. Eric Adams has to listen to us. In the halls of government, it says, of the people, by the people, for the people. It doesn't say of the government, of the developer, by the developer, and for the developer.
Democracy Now!'s Sanji Lopez, thank you for that report. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, this week marks the end of the Supreme Court's current term. Tuesday, voting rights advocates welcomed a decision in a major election law case that preserved checks and balances in elections. In a 6-3 decision, the justices dismissed the so-called independent state legislature theory, that state legislatures have nearly unlimited power to make rules for federal elections and draw partisan congressional maps that are not subject to review by state courts. This is White House spokesperson Olivia Dalton responding to the decision in Moore v. Harper.
We're pleased that the Supreme Court rejected the extreme legal theory presented in this case, which would have interfered with state governments, which would have opened the door for politicians to undermine the will of the people.
This comes as the Supreme Court is set to issue major decisions Thursday and Friday, including on student debt and affirmative action. For more, we're joined by Michael Waldman, president and CEO of the Brennan Center for Justice. His new book on how Supreme Court's conservative majority has ushered in a radical new era is titled The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America. His piece on Tuesday's ruling is headlined The Independent State Legislature Theory is dead. Michael, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Why don't you start off by explaining who Moore and who Harper are and why this decision, which for many may sound very bureaucratic, is so fundamental and is such a surprise in the way the Supreme Court, the conservative Supreme Court, ruled?
It was fundamental. I don't know that it was such a surprise because this was such a crackpot idea. that it would have been an utter revolution in our democracy had they done anything other than what they did. The facts of the case make that pretty clear. North Carolina is an evenly divided state, Democrat and Republican. They have a Democratic governor and Republican legislature. The legislature drew a congressional map that was very, very gerrymandered for the Republicans. It was 11 Republican seats and I think 3 or 4 Democratic seats. The state Supreme Court there said that's unconstitutional under our state constitution. And the legislature said, you have no role here. We get to do whatever we want. They claimed, and some of the MAGA lawyers have begun to claim, that the Constitution gives state legislatures the power to set election rules for federal elections with no checks and balances from state courts or constitutions or governors or the voters. And that nobody noticed it until now. And it's a crackpot idea, and it has never been found by another court. So it's great that the court rejected it. They should never have taken the case. They were pretty strong in the language they used, but by this point, it was not such a surprise. I will say the Voting Rights Act case a couple of weeks ago was more of a surprise to those of us watching the court.
And Michael, what does this mean now in terms of the redistricting of North Carolina? What happens now in that state in particular?
Well, North Carolina, interestingly, will be affected by this less than many other places. That's because during the most recent election, the voters chose conservative justices for the state Supreme Court. So even though the Supreme Court there blocked the gerrymander last year, the new Supreme Court majority has said, oh, it's just fine. So this doesn't actually affect what's going on in North Carolina. However, it will continue to empower state courts around the country to block gerrymanders, to police the legislatures, and to keep legislators from trying to entrench themselves or advance their party with these egregious maps. So it's pretty important in that way. It also makes clear that as we look toward 2024 and the potential problems that we would have in that election, that again, state courts can play their appropriate role. There's some language in there that gives people a little bit of pause to make sure that it doesn't turn into the next problem. But it basically says the way it's been done for the last 200 years is how it should be still done.
So talk about your reservation that this isn't quite as much of a victory as some are hailing it. The whole issue of the court saying that state courts themselves can't go beyond their bounds, but giving a lot of power to the federal courts, Michael Waldman.
Yeah, we think this is an extraordinary victory. That is the worry that some observers have. And of course, it's worth watching out for. I would say in some respects that this was not new, that the federal courts already were going to police the state courts if they really went off the rails. The standards here are a little fuzzy, and there's always a risk that it could become grounds for federal judges to try to interfere in what's going on in the states. Perhaps I'm a bit cynical, but I think they already had that ability anyway. So I don't think it changes that much. But some who've looked at it worry that that's the next problem, and I have to refer to the independent state legislature theory. I have to remember to refer to it. First of all, calling it a theory is very generous. It's a crackpot idea. It was never actually a theory, but it's in the past tense. It's been rejected very roundly. But, of course, we want to make sure that these Federalist Society right-wing federal judges don't overstep their bounds in policing what state courts do when they're dealing with federal elections.
And Michael, I wanted to ask you about one of the upcoming decisions that millions of Americans, especially those with student debt, are mm-hmm. eyeing now that will occur in the next few days. What's your sense of how the court will act? Also, there are progressive activists who argue that if the Supreme Court strikes down Biden's debt relief plan, that he still has the authority to forgive student loans under the Higher Education Act. What's the potential of him doing that? If and also, the advisability of that as an alternate path to debt forgiveness?
So you're exactly right that it there are a few more days left in the Supreme Court term, and they still have quite a few big decisions to announce. One of them is this student debt relief plan. This is something that even the Biden administration worried was on shaky constitutional ground when they did it, for something like this to be done by him through executive action. The interesting question here is, will the court strike it down, or will they say, well, we might not like this, but the people who are bringing this case lack what's called standing, meaning they can't really show they were injured that by somebody else getting their student debt relieved in that way. And there was a ruling the other day where they blocked or they rejected Texas's effort to force the Biden administration to change its immigration policy. They said Texas lacked standing, and it may be that this is an area where they're saying to red states or right-wing activists, you know, we're a pretty conservative court, we're a pretty extreme court, but you can't just take an op-ed and send it to us and ask us to implement it. You need to follow some more of the rules. I think it's also the case, looking forward, that it's been a conservative crusade to limit standing in the federal courts because they don't want environmentalists and activists and community groups to be suing conservative administrations over things like the environment and other matters. You know, whether and how there might be other steps on student debt that the administration could take, partly will, I guess, depend on what kind of ruling they get. The Biden administration has been reluctant to do this. They have generally not pushed the executive power beyond the lines of its extent, and I don't know whether they would here or not. But they do have ways to do different things using different parts of the law that they haven't always used.
And Michael Waldman, affirmative action. Can you talk about what the court is deciding and how significant it is if they rule against affirmative action? Do colleges, universities have to abide by what they say?
Yeah, this, you know, in all likelihood, will be the blockbuster case of the term, and they're saving it for the last episode of the season, as they sometimes do, or they're like finishing their term papers and saving their work for the last minute. The Supreme Court is hearing challenges to affirmative action, to the use of race as a factor for university admissions in both public and private universities. Two different cases, one from Harvard, one from the University of North Carolina. This is, of course, a really big deal. And most observers do expect them to rule that you cannot use race as a factor in admissions in the way that has been done for years now in higher education. It would be hugely consequential at a time of massive demographic change and massive pressure on our university systems. The universities around the country, as I understand it, have already anticipated a lot of these rulings and are looking to make changes. You know, one of the questions is, are there other ways to promote diversity, including on class or location, that will not just replicate the kind of old school white traditional student bodies of the past, but will enable universities to continue to seek a diverse student body. You know, there was a great question that Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson asked during the oral argument in this case that shows how disruptive this could be. She said, well, there's two essays applying for college. One is from somebody who says, I want to go to UNC because my grandfather went there, and it'll mean a lot to me to go there for that reason. The other person writes and says, I want to go to UNC because my grandfather could not go there because of his race, and therefore it would mean a lot to me to go there. Are they really saying that you cannot say that or take that into account in the second essay, but you can, in effect, take white race into account, as in the first essay? You can see how disruptive this would be, and it'll affect a lot of things going forward.
Michael, I want to turn a little to your book, The Supermajority, How the Supreme Court Divided America. You raise several important points there. One is the unique role of the Supreme Court in our country versus high courts in other countries. And you also talk about why 2022 was such a seminal or pivotal moment in terms of how the Supreme Court acts. Could you elaborate on both of those?
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. We take for granted that we have this court that is nine unelected people serving for lifetime terms that has so much power that we sit around every June wondering what rulings are they going to make and what country do we live in as a result. And it has this power only because we, the people, give it this power. It has developed over time. It really depends on the public's faith in the court as at least something like above politics or at least not a purely political, purely ideological, purely power-driven actor. In 2022 was the first full term of the supermajority of six very conservative justices who you and your viewers are, of course, familiar with how they got installed. Six very conservative justices, their first term, and they moved the court and therefore the country hard to the right. In 3 days last June, first they did a decision called Bruin, which was by far the most sweeping Second Amendment ruling in the country's history. It basically said you cannot, when considering the constitutionality of a gun rule, you cannot take public safety today into account. You can only look at, quote, history and tradition, meaning what were the rules back then in the founding era, say. The next day was Dobbs, which, of course, was the first time the Supreme Court revoked a constitutional fundamental right recognized by the courts for half a century by overturning Roe v. Wade and the right to reproductive choice, and did it in a way that puts many, many other privacy rights at risk. And then the third big decision got less attention. It was called West Virginia versus EPA, where they began the project, and they're continuing it strongly, of curbing the power of regulatory agencies to protect the public on issues like the environment, worker safety, and other things like that. They crammed decades of social policy into those 3 days. And I think, you know, the country is moving in one direction and the court is veering sharply in another direction. That creates a crisis. Its public trust has collapsed in the past year, according to all public opinion polls. There's nonstop controversies and scandals. And I think that we're seeing a real reaction and a real response and a real pushback, which will help shape our politics going forward.
And Michael Waldman, we just have about a minute, but I wanted to ask you about these controversies swirling around one Supreme Court justice after another and whether there will be rules imposed. You've got the mega donors, the billionaires, Harlan Crow and Justice Clarence Thomas. You've got Paul Singer, the mega donor, both of them having major business before the Supreme Court. Singer with his relationship with Samuel Alito. Neither of them disclosing this. So if they say it really didn't matter, then why didn't they disclose it on their forms? What kind of regulation do you see needs to happen? What kind of rules do these Supreme Court justices have to abide by that haven't been imposed?
Well, Alito, remember, said, I can take this travel because he's my friend, and then also said, but I can vote on his cases because I barely know the guy. So, you know, it is a real problem. The Supreme Court is the only court in the United States that does not have to follow a binding code of ethics. Nobody is so wise that they should be the judge in their own case. So they, at the very least, minimally, need a binding code of ethics. Congress can pass that, but the court could do it, too. I think it's really important also that we look at term limits for Supreme Court justices, an 18-year term, say, with the presidents each getting to make an appointment every 2 years. These are very popular across left and right. It's actually something that people get, the idea that nobody should have too much public power for too long. That could be done by constitutional amendment. It could also be done, we think, at the Brennan Center by statute. If you look at the state Supreme Courts, every one of them but one has either term limits or a retirement age. It helps make the court more accountable, helps drain some of the politics and toxicity out of the nominations. These kinds of reforms are among the things we need to be doing right now to bring the Supreme Court in line with our Constitution and our democracy.
Michael Waldman, we want to thank you so much for being with us, President and CEO of the Brennan